Welcome to Citizens Climate University, a weekly webinar program of Citizens Climate Lobby that provides CCL supporters with access to in-depth training opportunities on topics related to climate change and effective climate advocacy. Tonight's topic is CCL's 2024 Conservative Conference Highlights, where right-of-center people met and discussed climate policy and then spent a day meeting with Republican senators and representatives on Capitol Hill. I'm your host, Todd Elvin, CCL's National Actions Director, and thank you for joining us. So let's jump right in with video highlights from the March 19th and 20th conference in Washington, D.C. These are hot off the press, and thanks to Brett Sees for recording these and putting these videos together. So we're going to start. The first segment is from Neil Chatterjee. Neil is the former commissioner and chairman of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, FERC, and a member of the CCL Governing Board, and he's going to give us some keynote remarks.
Group, and this is the first time I've gotten to speak from my new capacity serving on the board, so it's a true honor to not just be speaking to you all, but to be a part of this distinguished organization. I'm really proud of it. I'm eventually going to get into my remarks and talk about my experiences at FERC and on the Hill and on some of the policy matters of the day. But I wanted to start because I thought it was very kind to say that, that I've developed a good reputation with staff. But I think what is notable is staff on both sides of the aisle. And as you guys are making the rounds on the Hill tomorrow, I thought it'd be worth noting a couple of things because, look, it took me a while to get adjusted, and still in my new capacity in the private sector, it's taken me a while to get adjusted. One thing you'll realize very quickly is, you know, staff on the Hill, particularly on the House side, are really, really young, and there's a tendency to kind of be like, oh my God, I'm talking to a 10-year-old. But the fact is, you know, these are really capable kids who get these jobs because they're very talented, because they work really hard. Most of them, you know, work long hours for very little pay. They ran a gauntlet to get a job on Capitol Hill, which is not an easy thing to do, and I think that's really important. Two, you know, if you can make a good impression with the staffer, a lot of times it can be frustrating because these young staffers, you know, they're very talented and they're ambitious, and so you meet, you know, at this meeting with one, and then by the June meeting they've already moved to another job, and then by next year you come back and they're in another job. That's okay too, because what happens is, like it happened to me when I inherited a portfolio, you get the notes from the person who had the job before you. And so if the staffer you're meeting with tomorrow has a favorable impression, then they're going to convey that to their successor in the job. So don't get frustrated by the fact that there's frequent turnover on Capitol Hill. And the third thing you got to understand is, you know, at the end of the day, staffers represent their principals, and they're going to do what is in the best interest of their principals, and they understand what their principals' motivations are. And there may be times where, you know, you make a connection with a staffer and you think this staffer really gets it and is going to be, you know, fully with me, or this staffer was rough and they're not going to support what we're trying to do. At the end of the day, they're going to do what's in the best interest of the principal, regardless of what their personal feelings are. And so I think understanding the principal's views when you go into the meeting is really, really important. I say all this to say that there's many, many different complex reasoning that goes into decision making on Capitol Hill. And to the extent that you can be empathetic when going in, and the reason that I have the reputation that I have with staff on both sides of the aisle is that I found that, you know, you can disagree without being disagreeable. And I think a lot of people don't understand that. I got yelled at a lot when I was a staffer, and I really got yelled at a lot when I was chairman of FERC. And, you know, it's just, you know, what's the line? You catch more bees than honey, than vinegar, or something to that effect. Just be nice to people. That's all. That's my big advice. So good luck tomorrow. You know, it's, I used to always, you know, say to my family that when I've been here since 2003 now, that when I walk up to the Capitol Dome, the day that I'm not a little bit inspired by looking at that beautiful building, that's the day that it's time for me to leave. And it hasn't happened yet. And so I appreciate you all being here in Washington to advocate on behalf of these important issues that we all care about, but also take a moment to breathe it in and appreciate what a privilege it is to be able to come in and to lobby our federal government. It's a wonderful, wonderful thing. With that, I'll start quickly by, you know, kind of getting into the substance of my remarks. And I guess where I'll start with first is with FERC and, you know, what the FERC? Like, why do you guys even care about what I have to say about anything? I think it's important a little bit to provide some background about FERC, about what it is and why it's really, really important. Not just its responsibilities, but its configuration and the role it plays in our energy regulatory landscape. So FERC is an independent agency with a bipartisan configuration, and no more than three members of the commission can come from one political party. And the reason for this is that the commission's responsibility, which is primarily oversight of the reliability of the grid, to make sure that when Americans hit the switch, the lights come on, that they stay affordable, that they stay safe, that they stay clean, that is an awesome responsibility, coupled with the responsibility to evaluate energy infrastructure projects ranging from natural gas pipelines to liquefied natural gas export facilities to setting ROE for transmission lines to hydroelectric licensing. It really is the country's foremost energy regulator. In fact, when Secretary Rick Perry, former governor of Texas, was serving as Secretary of Energy, you know, I used to joke with him that I think the Department of Energy is actually misnamed, that it should be called the Department of Science, because if any of you all have seen Oppenheimer, you know that that's DOE's primary purview, is oversight of the scientific laboratories and the nuclear fleet, and that FERC is really the country's principal energy regulator. He would just roll his eyes at me and laugh in his Texas way, but I really think FERC plays that critical role. But I mentioned its structure and independence. And let me explain for a moment why that is so critical to you all as you think through even your Hill advocacy tomorrow. So FERC being independent, FERC having five members who each serve staggered five-year terms to ensure that members are independent from the president that appoints them is really, really important and significant, because I think FERC has been a beacon of stability in an otherwise volatile regulatory landscape. What do I mean by that? You look at US EPA, for instance. EPA went one direction under the Obama administration, went a completely different direction under the Trump administration, has whipsawed back completely in a different direction under the Biden administration, and potentially could whipsaw again in a different direction under a Trump 2.0. And I gotta tell you, as people who work on advocating for long-term planning and policies, it is maddening to try to peg your advocacy and your decision-making to the political pendulum swinging wildly back and forth like that. Did FERC go in a different direction under my leadership than my predecessors in the Obama administration? Sure, but it wasn't a dramatically different direction. Has FERC gone in a different direction under my successors in the Biden administration than when I led the commission? Absolutely, but it hasn't been a dramatically different direction. And that's very, very important, that kind of, you know, consistency and balance, because as everything has become politicized, having that stability, in my view, is more important than ever.
All right, that was Neil Chatterjee, the former commissioner and chairman of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. Our next video clip highlight is from Grace Stanky. She's a nuclear fuels engineer and clean energy advocate. This session examines how nuclear power can play a pivotal role in our energy future.
Thank you so much for having me here today. You guys are in a really unique position to be able to be lobbying tomorrow. I hear that you're pushing for the ADVANCE Act. I was pushing for that in December, actually, and I still am supporting it as much as I can in the role that I have now. And I really want to take this time to share with you how I advocate for nuclear and how I talk about nuclear in a way that hasn't necessarily been addressed before. Now, throughout my year as Miss America, I got a lot of questions. One of them being, how the heck did you become a nuclear engineer? Like, what happened in that chain reaction of events in your life that led to nuclear engineering and Miss America at the same time, right? Lots of questions there. And I like to tell this story to not only people in general, but to politicians and to young people, because it's something that brings the human aspect. So when I was 15, 16-year-old teenage girl, I had no idea what I wanted to do with my life. How many of you in this room are parents? Okay, a lot of people in this room. So if you've had a teenage daughter, typically around that age. She has no idea what she wants to do with her life. I'm 21. I still have no idea what I want to do with my life, right? Like, that doesn't necessarily go away, but you find a direction. Now, I had grown up watching my dad, a civil engineer, go to work, build bridges, and I'd see him demo them overnight. I'd watch these bridges get built or repaired within spans of weeks, sometimes years, depending on the DOT project funding. You know, it's fine. And I loved seeing him use math and science for a good purpose. He was using these skills that typically were seen as a difficult and painful thing in school, but using it to help people live their lives better, more efficiently, more effectively. And I thought, how cool is this? For me personally, on the school side, I was always so frustrated in English class because I'd get an essay back and they'd go, "You're almost there." I'm like, "What do you mean? I'm either right or I'm wrong. Not almost there, all right?" But math and science had a clear distinction. I'm either right or wrong. So for my personality, I appreciated that. Now then, moving forward, I knew I liked engineering enough that I wanted to go into it. But that first semester of college, boy, there was a lot of learning happening. I learned that there is indeed more than two reactors in all of America. I learned that nuclear powers 20% of the country. I learned that nuclear medicine is the reason my dad's alive today. He's a two-time cancer survivor, and he would not be here if it were not for nuclear medicine. That was the best I told you so moment going back home. That was a fun Thanksgiving that year. I said, "Haha, you said there's no future here. You wouldn't have one if it weren't for nuclear." All right. We have a very fun, loving relationship. So in that sense, I said to myself, after learning how nuclear science is all around us, one of my favorite things to talk about, you know, how many of you have had a banana in the past week? Bananas are radioactive. Avocados? I love avocados. Avocados are radioactive. Granite countertops at home. Those are radioactive. Nuclear science is a part of our everyday life. We just don't know it. That first semester in college, I learned how this hidden science was positively influencing us in ways we didn't even know, in ways I didn't even know at the time. And honestly, in my mind, I said to myself, why isn't everybody shouting this from the rooftops? If this science is already impacting our lives, saving people from cancer, powering 20% of America with clean, effective, and reliable energy, why isn't everybody on board with this, and why don't we have overwhelming support? So I decided to do something about it. That freshman year is when I really started advocating for nuclear, and honestly, I didn't plan on doing this much, but here I am. At that point in time, I started just at that grassroots level. I always say I ask people to start their family Thanksgiving fight. You know, when your crazy Aunt Linda or your grandma comes or whoever it might be, and they're asking you all those weird questions, you know, it's sometimes all it takes is, do you know where your power comes from? Do you know you as an American citizen have the ability to influence your utility bill at the end of the month? Because most people don't. The way you vote, that dictates how that utility bill looks, even though it's a privatized industry for the most part. Now going through, I went through and I started really at that grassroots level, starting my family Thanksgiving fight, going back to my high school classes to just talk in the physics classrooms about, okay, what is nuclear science? What is nuclear energy? It was pretty underwhelming when people learned it's just fancy hot rocks boiling water to turn a turbine. Congrats, you're all nuclear engineers now. That's it. Fancy hot rocks, that's all we do. Now going through, I took a step back and I decided I want to do this on a bigger level. And I was in college. College is very expensive, if you didn't know that. I was looking for scholarship opportunities at the time. And I started competing in the Miss Wisconsin organization. And I became Miss Madison, went to the competition, the state level, the first year, placed top 10, walked away, competed a second year, and went back to Miss Wisconsin for the second time. Now that second time I did become Miss Wisconsin, and I'm so thankful for those years of being involved in Miss America. Not only have I earned $70,000 in scholarships, which allows me to graduate with my undergrad completely debt-free and also go and get a master's completely for free if I wanted, it also is something that taught me communication and interview skills and posture and eye contact, all of those little things that you don't get taught in school anymore. Now part of the competition is you have to choose something to promote. When I was a teenager, I probably would have done something along the lines of supporting cancer patients and ensuring that they have access to things that they need when they're having long hospital stays. That's just from my shared experience when my dad was going through cancer. But as an adult, I said, let's talk about nuclear energy. Let's see what happens here. How many Miss America people have you heard of talking about nuclear energy? Not many. You know, I've done a pretty extensive, like, deep dive into the archives of Miss America to see if anybody else has even been a nuclear engineer or been involved in energy or electricity. Pretty sure I'm the first in a 102-year-old organization. Now, I went through, and all of a sudden, became Miss Wisconsin. And all of a sudden, I had a job of being Miss Wisconsin. I had to take a step back from school and commit to doing this full-time. Which is a little fun fact for those of you that don't know. Some of those state title holder jobs are full-time positions.
All right, that was Grace Stanky. And again, you can watch the full videos. They are on Vimeo, and you can get to them by going to cclusa.org/presentations. Our next video highlight is from Katrina Rourke. She's the Senior Vice President of Policy and Research at the Climate Leadership Council. This session discusses using trade to address climate change and, in particular, carbon border adjustment mechanisms, or CBAMs, which could be used to collect a fee at the border from high-polluting countries that undercut our domestic manufacturers with their cheaper carbon-heavy products.
Thanks for having me today. As much as my history is like yours in carbon pricing, today we're going to be talking about CBAM. Carbon border adjustment mechanisms. And if I can get the clicker to work, awesome. Okay, this can work. All right, so what we're going to talk about today are all of the different proposals that are coming out around the world aiming to introduce into the global marketplace a price on carbon. We're going to start by getting really hype about the instrument. This is a measurement of the carbon loophole. The darker blue or purple or whatever tone that's coming out as, that's the portion of emissions that are embodied in goods that get traded overseas. So these are our goods for which the emissions to generate them are happening in a different country than they are consumed. It's a significant measurement because it indicates that trade is a significant part of the globe's emissions profile. It's also significant because the vast majority of global carbon trade flows, I'll explain more in a second, move emissions from low ambition, high emissions intensity countries into high climate ambition, low emissions countries. So all of these spaghetti lines are carbon flows, the carbon emissions associated with goods that get manufactured in the country of origin and then consumed elsewhere. And if you squint, you'll notice that a whole lot of the most significant carbon flows are coming out of China, the manufacturing powerhouse, not known for its climate ambition. Also huge flows are moving to the US, to the European Union. We're seeing a tremendous amount of activity here, shifting emissions off our balance sheets and onto theirs. The way we address those emissions is by introducing a price on those goods. And this is a map of the carbon intensity of manufacturing. You don't need to read all of these line items. What you do need to look for are the red boxes. The red boxes indicate a manufacturing sector that requires more carbon emissions in a non-US country. So we've got, roughly speaking, primary goods at the top and more manufactured goods at the bottom. And you'll see across the whole supply chain, a lot of red boxes. It requires more emissions to create the same dollar of value manufacturing any given good on a global average than in the United States, and certainly in economies like China, India, Russia, that require a whole lot more emissions than we do, again, to create the same dollar of value. The flip side of this is that if we're pricing the emissions associated with traded goods, we're creating new competitive opportunities for the firms that are doing it best. We're leveling the playing field. And leveling the playing field on an international basis allows us to drive more investment, more job creation in US, more carbon efficient firms. Pretty cool. This is also a really popular policy angle. I'm sure, like me, You have studied the polling on carbon pricing. It's not great. Everybody wants climate action. Nobody wants to pay for it at all. A dollar is too much. Once you introduce the concept that a carbon price can drive job creation and economic opportunity in the United States, that hesitancy to pay is destroyed. So you'll see our first question here is the concept of introducing a fee on imported goods based on their carbon pollution. Really robust bipartisan support, 61% Republicans, 81% Democrats, if that's not clear in the back of the room. All right, and now we say, would you be willing to pay more for a product if that product was made in the United States, and paying more would help create jobs here by bringing more manufacturing and production back to America, and support goes up. So by linking your interest in paying for the good of addressing climate change to your interest in supporting homegrown job creation, we're seeing an increase in support for a climate tool. Awesome. And then our last sort of hype slide, I think this is our last hype slide, is that our geopolitical enemies know that this is a powerful mechanism. Before Russia invaded Ukraine, so we're talking about a series of economic sanctions from more than 2 years ago, which were still pretty steep. The Russian oil czar Igor Sechin said that border carbon charges applied by the EU, so he's considering the EU CBAM, we'll talk about it in a minute, would cause incomparably greater damage to the Russian economy than the sanctions that the global community had applied on Russia in order to damage their economy. And then a Chinese study examined how the European CBAM would impact manufacturing in China, and they identified that just the European Union adopting these policies would result in a reduction to Chinese GDP by 0.64% and destroy 2.3 million Chinese manufacturing jobs. So they know it's powerful. If we're talking about it, they've got to do something about it.
That was Katrina Rourke, Senior Vice President at the Climate Leadership Council. Our next video highlight is the Farm Bill panel, moderated by CCL Vice President of Government Affairs, Ben Pendergrass. In this video highlight, we'll hear from expert panelists as they lay out the challenges and opportunities and what climate provisions may be included in the new version of the five-year Farm Bill. Our two panelists are Morgan Brummond, Government Affairs Director at the American Conservation Coalition Action, and Andrew Mills, Vice President of Political Affairs, National Audubon Society, and Executive Director, Audubon Action Fund.
I mean, obviously, folks might remember the Farm Bill originally expired last September. Ideally, like, you get that done before it expires. We're living under a year-long extension. There was some discussion of them moving early in the year on the Farm Bill, and timelines keep shifting. I swear I heard something like 3 weeks ago, and now I heard something completely different 3 days ago. What are you guys hearing about timelines and how the process might continue to play out or not play out in the coming weeks?
I feel like Mills already touched on this, and he's also where I get a lot of my intel. So, I mean, he's probably best equipped to speak to this. But to be blunt, I would say we really don't know what's going to happen. And we have to be realistic about that. And I think that it's wonderful that you all are going to talk to them tomorrow, because this just has to be something that our groups are collectively going to remind them of. There are repercussions if we don't get a Farm Bill passed. I think it's pretty likely that we will see something introduced in committee this year, this spring, this summer perhaps. But I don't necessarily think, based on where we're at within Congress and just the conflicts within the House and the Senate majorities, I just don't necessarily, and I'm pretty optimistic, I don't necessarily think that we're going to get a Farm Bill passed. And so this is a larger conversation, an ongoing conversation, and I think it's going to take groups like ours to not budge and still have those conversations throughout this year and next year if it comes to that.
Given where three people have worked on the issue of climate that are Republicans for the last several years, I'd say we're very optimistic. If you're looking at the House right now this week, they can't even get the funding bill done. This has been percolating for how long? They kicked out the former speaker, nothing's changed. The big thing we're looking at is, are they actually getting floor time? That was the excuse before, especially from Congressman Thompson, the chairman of that committee. There's nothing guaranteed at this point. I think they need to figure out, obviously they finally did last night on funding the government, but who knows what's gonna happen there. We're really looking forward to a month or two. We're gonna be in the heart of the political season, primary season, which just makes it way more difficult. So what does that mean? I think to Morgan's point on the committees have to show action on this bill. If they don't show action, CBO will score it next year. It'll get way more costly, which Republicans very much want to avoid. So there is something that is incentivizing them to act, at least on the committee level. We are hopeful it gets done, I assume, from what I'm hearing, by Memorial Day. So who knows, the Senate is probably similar. One of them just has to show action, and then who knows what happens later in the year. I think it just depends on what happens with the election.
I just think it would be good to, like, just to see what the process might play out. I think it's pretty, and you guys have been pretty uniformly, like, accepted that the House will probably take action first, that the Senate wants to wait and see what the House does. That the House will probably move a partisan Republican-only bill first that fails on the floor, because almost every other Congress, the Farm Bill has to be bipartisan to pass, and there's just not the votes there for it to pass, but it isn't bipartisan. But so we kind of will have this process where a bill goes to the floor, it fails, and then they got to go back and design a bill that can get Democratic votes, and then maybe then the Senate starts to move. Is that what you guys think the process will play out? Or things shifted around since last week?
Things always shift around. Every week we're making history here, right? No, if you look at the historic, just the Farm Bill getting passed, it's always been bipartisan. It's usually very passionate at the committee level. We have a lot of farmers. We have a lot of people who've worked this, and I mean, there's plenty of other titles in this, SNAP, others. People that have worked this and understand this, members of Congress, I should say, want to get it done in a thoughtful manner, and when it usually moves to the floor, it's not confrontational, and this is a different year. I also just look at, and a lot of what Morgan and I, our organization, has been doing this year is just educating, because there's so many new members that have never done a farm bill before. It's historic. Most of the committee is new. So really, to the point of explaining, you have to explain what the Farm Bill is in the certain titles and why this matters and yada, yada, yada. But I think just to the point of, we're in historic times, it's extremely difficult to gauge how this is going to play out. I think they will push forward a much more Republican bill. I'm curious to see how we have a group that we've talked to that understand these programs, understand that they want to protect climate money, that are Republicans. And it's just making sure we have enough to stick together to either get something out of the committee, but if it moves to the floor, it's not going to pass. And they know that. They're not going to be willing to risk that in the election cycle.
I would also just add that majority in the Senate has said multiple times that they're not willing to budge on this funding. And I think that that's an element that we have to consider. And we also have to consider that we don't know what Congress is going to look like by November. And I think that Mills is just getting into the aspect of a big part of the conversations that I'm having is just educating staff and members on, you know, why this funding is important, what it does for the American farmer. And we might have to restart that, to be quite frank with you all. And so I think that just to hit home, the fact that you all are having this conversation now is really important, and it's going to continue to be really important as we move forward.
So thank you for joining, and I hope you enjoyed the video highlights from the Conservative Conference. Thank you for joining this special training, and you can see all of CCL's conference videos and presentations at cclusa.org/presentations. And if you have questions, you can ask on CCL's site-wide forum. Thanks for being here. Good to see you all.
Good.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Citizens Climate Lobby's training program. You can tune into more episodes anywhere podcasts are available. Inspired by what you heard today? Join Citizens Climate Lobby to advocate for bipartisan climate solutions. Go to community.citizensclimate.org to find more trainings, resources, your local chapter, national action teams, discussion forums, and more. Be sure to like our Facebook page and follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Citizens Climate. We also invite all of our listeners to subscribe to our YouTube channel for more inspiration.
Like what you hear? Recommend us to your friends and make sure to give us a 5-star rating. It helps us show up on other listeners' feeds. Feel free to pass on any suggestions for future episodes in the comments as well.
And together, we are creating the political will for a livable world.